Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again. Unbelievable! Mayweather makes him pay. What a rookie mistake. A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's fact, I'm the best. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe in myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Episode 70 of the Last Round Podcast, coming off of the probably the most hyped weekend of boxing in terms of one event. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I would definitely say definitely one of the biggest, if not the biggest of this year. And I'm still in shock, to be honest with you.
I think a lot of people are. But once again, guys, thank you for joining us this week on the Last Round, whether you're listening to on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all those podcasting platforms. I'm sure we're on there. We appreciate it. And then, you know, of course, we're going to start here with Wilder versus Fury and all the crazy outcomes and crazy stuff that happened from that fight. And who better to have to discuss that fight, to provide his analysis, who he was just there. He was in Las Vegas in the flesh. To deliver the lineal title, the Ring Magazine belt, as the number one versus the number two heavyweight faced off in Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder. I think this is what, Mike, his third time on the show?
I believe so.
Dougie Fisher, the editor-in-chief of Ring Magazine, is back. How's it going, Dougie?
Hey, it's going well, guys. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. So, as we just mentioned, you were obviously there this weekend. And the question I want to start with, that I think a lot of people want to know, is what's your take on the 45-pound costume that Wilder wore to the ring?
I think it's ridiculous. It's as simple as that. I like the showmanship from both Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder. But the thing is, if the showmanship is going to weigh on your shoulders physically, as in a 45-pound suit, or psychologically, just by putting pressure on you, then you have to push the showmanship aside. And I think Deontay Wilder has a problem doing that, especially when he's faced with Tyson Fury, because Fury has a way of playing on Wilder's insecurities, even though Wilder won't admit to having insecurities. Or often Wilder will try to project fears and insecurities onto Fury. It just rolls off of Fury's big shoulders. Like Fury, it's natural. It's second nature to him to be bombastic, to make use of bluster, to say whatever pops into his head. And it doesn't really have any meaning with him. But when he gets into Wilder's face and says things like, I'm going to knock you out in two rounds, or I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that, or whatever, it bothers Wilder. And I think when Wilder tries to play that game and tries to one-up Tyson Fury, he's playing Tyson Fury's game. Now, I'm not saying entering the ring in an elaborate get-up looking like Lord Zedd from the Power Rangers or Black Manta or whatever. I'm into all that stuff.
What a reference, Dougie. What a reference. Yeah.
I'm into cosplay, but the thing is if it's going to inhibit you or bother you or any way or disrupt anything that has to do with the game plan that his team has going into that fight or during that fight, then it's a problem. And it sounds ridiculous to be quite honest. It's like, 45 pounds. Okay. I mean, listen, my backpack was probably 45 pounds. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I was carrying around the Ring Magazine title,
yeah,
you know, along with a bunch of magazines, along with my laptop, along with an extra jacket because it gets cold in the arena and I was sick all week. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You walk around with stuff. You know what I mean? It's just like, really? So that one ring walk from your dressing room to the ring, having that suit on, damaged your legs? It sounds like a ridiculous excuse. And by the way, I'm not ruling out that it didn't do that. But if it did do that, then Wilder's an idiot for putting it on. And the people around him are idiots for allowing him to do so. Somebody has to be an adult. Like, dude, it's too much. What are you putting on? It's like, is that like actual machinery? Wait, the eyes glow? The eyes light up? What are you doing? Like, you got to be focused. You got to be focused, and you got to be relaxed. And he did not seem relaxed from the final press conference on Wednesday. It seems to me that Fury was in his head, rent-free, and Fury's words got his heart racing. It got his blood pressure up, and it stayed up. That's what it seemed like to me.
You know, at following, you know, especially with him saying these excuses, especially the costume, the 45 pounds or whatever was affecting his legs. And, you know, I immediately thought about when Joshua lost to Ruiz last year. And then, you know, obviously us as the press or just reporters in general, like they try to find out, especially when you're a high profile person, high profile athlete. And then there was reports that Joshua was knocked out in sparring and something was wrong with him mentally, or he had like a panic attack or something.
Right.
But he never, at least, you know, not initially for the first, you know, few months or several months, something like that. He never made excuses. And that, that came to my mind when I began to see the Wilder excuses. You know, how do you see in comparison between Anthony Joshua's loss to Andy Ruiz the first time to Wilder's loss to Tyson Fury this past weekend in terms of their reactions?
I thought Joshua handled his loss with more class. I think when, you know, you lose a fight and you're interviewed and the first thing out of your mouth is no excuses, well, I don't think you should follow up that with an excuse. Mm-hmm. I don't think you should say no excuses, yeah. But my leg was already kind of messed up. Well, that's an excuse. Why say no excuses? You know, why say that? So I think Joshua handled it with a little more class and grace. I think Wilder tried to. But Wilder he's an emotional dude. Mm-hmm. And what he's feeling, it's gonna come out of his mouth. And he can't really hide it. So if that's what he's feeling, if he feels that's the reason, so be it. I don't think it's a good look. I don't think it was a good look. His head trainer, JD's, contradicting the actions of co-trainer Mark Breland and saying Breland should not have thrown the towel in. I don't think that's a good look, but I mean, if that's how they really feel, then, you know, you have to respect it. Okay. If they want to enact that immediate third match, then fine. And if they want to have excuses going into a third match, then that's fine. But, you know, the thing is, you know, after the first fight, Wilder said, well, you know, I admit I was angry and I was trying too hard for the knockout. And then he said, you know, I had an arm injury or my right hand was injured. And so I didn't train the way I needed to train. You know, I went ahead and trained, but I couldn't really throw it in sparring and all. So it's like, you have to ask yourself, when are you going to be 100% for Tyson Fury? Because there was all kind of rumors about Tyson Fury's ankles. You know, there was the concerns about the cut, that horrendous cut that occurred during his fight with Otto Wallin. There was rumors of damaged shoulder or elbows from that WWE thing that he did. Mm-hmm. So there's all these rumors about that, but Fury really didn't entertain that, did he? He didn't really talk about it. Right. He didn't have a problem with people bringing it up because I think he knew that it was getting into to Wilder's head, and Wilder certainly brought it up a few times. But you know, the thing is, you know, are you going to be 100%? You know, and the truth is, professional fighters, especially at this level, they are seldom 100% when they enter that ring. Something's always hurting. I remember George Foreman used to say that a lot when he was an HBL broadcaster, and somebody would bring up the rumor of an injury mm-hmm. to one of the fighters that were in the HBO co-feature. And he would say, you're never 100%. You're always, something always hurts. Mm-hmm. You know, your hands hurt, your back hurts, your knees hurt. Something is always going to hurt on you when you're a prize fighter because you got to bang yourself up to get ready for war. And that's just the way it is. So I'm just wondering, it's like, okay, you know, they can put out these excuses, but if you're going to enact that third fight and go right into it, You're going to be fighting a version of Tyson Fury that might be better than the second time you fought him. You know, he's going to have another camp with Sugar Hill Stewart. You know what I mean? He's going to have more time for that eye to heal. He's going to have more time to add wrinkles to his game. Wrinkles such as the grab and hold and mount thing, the Emmanuel Stewart heavyweight tactics. You know, they're going to add more to his arsenal. Because I saw that with Fury. I saw he added a left hook. He added some body punches. He added the clinching, as I mentioned, along with the added body weight. And he made some adjustments from the first fight, right? He changed it up. And what I saw from Wilder was that he wasn't adapting to that. He wasn't changing it up with what Fury brought to the second fight. So that's what I think they need to be focused on, is how are they going to adapt? What are they going to change going from this setback into an immediate third bout if they enact that rematch clause?
Dougie, you touched on Deontay's kind of that mental health. Do you think that all the excuses are just to mask the fact that he kind of got completely outclassed in there? And,
yes.
And do you think they should?
Absolutely. And it's normal. It's natural. It's not. I'm not throwing shade on Wilder, although I'm sure Wilder would take it like that, or his hardcore fans would take it like that. But great heavyweights have done that. George Foreman did that after he lost to Muhammad Ali. He couldn't believe it. He couldn't accept it. He had, you know, he said, I was poisoned. You know, the government, I had death threats or whatever. You know, Vitaly Klitschko, when he lost to Lehman Brewster, he couldn't believe it. Like, I can't lose to Lehman Brewster. I'm an Olympic gold medalist. I'm an elite boxer. Lehman Brewster was a slugger. Lehman Brewster's biggest amateur credential was California State Golden Gloves. You know what I'm saying? He's like, how did I lose to this guy? It's like, oh, well, my cut man put Vaseline on my legs and my legs couldn't breathe. And so my body overheated. This is a college grad, right? You know, Vladimir Klitschko is intelligent.
Right. The
guy speaks like six languages. He's got a college degree. He's got a PhD. He's brilliant. He and his brother. But he's a human being and he's a competitor, and he couldn't handle losing. And you know, listen, Klitschko is a first ballot Hall of Famer. All right. And he's a gentleman and a class act, but he still had a hard time dealing with losing in the manner that he lost. And they threw a cup man. They threw the cup man under the bus. And it happens. And it looks like, I hope it's not the case, but it looks like Deontay Wilder and JD's are throwing Mark Breland under the bus. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a bad look, but I also understand they're human beings. They're very proud. They were very confident. Let me tell you something. They were very confident going into that fight. The mood, JD's was like a celebrity walking around, taking pictures with everybody right up until Saturday. He was very confident. Everybody who was picking and betting on Wilder was like, I'm about to cash in this lotto ticket. This is easy money.
Yeah.
They were all like that. Now, was Wilder like that? I don't know. I heard, you know, he was talking the talk, but you could tell that it weighed on his mind. He was doing a lot. He was engaging a lot with his fans, doing a lot of social media, doing a lot of media. I heard, you know, he's working mitts after the weigh-in, which why do you need to do that? Like, what's going on? And then when they showed shots of him in his dressing room, a couple hours before he would step into the ring with Tyson Fury, he's pacing back and forth. So, yeah, that's anxiety. That's I'm not going to say there's anything wrong with him. I mean, he's a live wire. He's an emotional, passionate individual. And the chemistry between he and Tyson Fury is such that Fury gets into his head. And that's all there is to it.
Dougie, do you think that they should take the rematch straight away? Or do you think they should go away, mentally rebuild, get a few victories, then come back?
Yeah. I think there needs to be some rebuilding. I don't know. I mean, he is what he is. He's a puncher. He's a pure puncher. That's what he relies on. He's 34 years old. He has 44 professional bouts. I don't know how much that can be changed, but I think you could add some wrinkles to his game. Listen, I thought he looked okay in the first two rounds. I scored them both for Fury, but I thought the second round was close. I thought both guys came out and did what they said they were going to do. Fury said he was going to take the fight to him, which he did. And that was a bit surprising. And Wilder said he was going to be more patient, and he was. And he said he was going to work the jab, and he did. He had a nice jab. I liked it to the body. I thought he looked okay in the first 6 minutes, but Fury was hitting him, and Wilder does not like to be hit. And Fury was forcing him on the back foot, forcing him to retreat a little bit, and you know, slowly undressing him, like not allowing, like gradually taking away Wilder's left stick, and also showing that he could take the right hand. You know, he didn't have to take it flush because he could turn with it or partially block it. But he was sort of taking away those weapons from Wilder. And basically after that third round knockdown, what was Wilder left with? Fierce pride. I think that was it. It was just like, okay, I'm not going to go away, but I don't know what to do. So he was bewildered in there and gradually being overwhelmed physically. But pride kept him up. But I mean, you know, pride will get you killed in a pride fight. So, I mean, a prize fight. Was it Andre Ward who always said this is prize fighting, not pride fighting?
Yeah, I think he did say that once or twice.
Listen, I think it's okay for it to be about pride with the fighters.
Right.
I don't think it should be about pride with the corner. That's very dangerous. That's potentially deadly.
Dougie, what did you think of the corner work? I thought at times you could see, you know, Wilder was getting completely outclassed, but JD just kept going to use the jab, the right hand, use the jab, the right hand. Yeah, very limited.
You go with what you know. And I think their motto is all's well that ends well. And it usually ends well, you know, with the exception of the first fight with Fury. They got the W. And the right hand was, you know, a force of nature last year. And maybe they bought into the mystique a little bit, but it's always that ship has always run on talent. And most of that talent was quick twitch athleticism, pretty good reflexes, and a massive right hand. So that's what Deez was going to go to. And in the Fury corner, I thought Sugar Hill was Sugar Hill. Sugar Hill is never excited. I mean, you could let an M80 off next to that dude, and he will barely flinch. He's probably a really good poker player. His facial expression seldom changes. He's monotone, in fact, and maybe that's perfect for Fury. Kept everything under control, and I thought he told Fury to do the right thing. I think when Fury was getting a little sloppy and starting to smother himself, he reminded Fury, your power is at mid-range. Your power is out here. Get the jab working again and get those 1-2s off as you come in. I think Fury, to his credit, listened and obeyed as best he could. He was certainly effective. It may not have mattered what was said in Wilder's corner. I think after the third round, he was really on instincts in there, which is why you had to be careful. Because if a fighter is just fighting on instincts, he doesn't really know what's going on, and he's gradually taking that punishment round after round. And I thought after the fifth round, it was essentially over. I thought after the fifth round, I didn't even think if he landed a flush right hand, I didn't think there was enough on it to turn the fight, to be quite honest, because Fury can take a pretty decent shot. And even if he gets dropped, he's the kind of guy to get up and get right back on the grind. So I essentially thought the fight was over, and I actually thought the sixth round was pretty hard to watch.
Dougie, you mentioned earlier how like when the fight started and Fury was essentially taking the fight to Wilder, even though he was kind of saying that leading up to the fight that he was going to take the fight to Wilder. That's why he made a switch to Sugar Hill. He wanted that aggressive style. Would you say that you and like maybe others, because there was a lot of people that was kind of like a consensus opinion that like, oh, you know, Fury isn't really that type of fighter,
right?
So would you say like the consensus was when he was like leading up to the event that he was just kind of publicizing the event, like saying like, you know, Fury's obviously an entertainer.
No. I don't think the switch in trainers was a publicity stunt. Mm-hmm. I think he was serious. I think Fury, you know, he idolizes great American trainers. And I think it was, I thought it was a psychological move, the way he brought in Freddie Roach for the final 2 weeks of his preparation for the first Wilder fight. He just, he feels comfortable being around like a Hall of Famer, you know?
Right.
And with Sugar Hill, it's like, okay, there's a connection to the late great Emmanuel Stewart, who he met and trained under briefly. And Manny Stewart always believed in Tyson Fury. So I thought it was a psychological thing. And I thought that it would help him with certain certain tactics that Stewart often used with tall, rangy, big heavyweights like Vladimir Klitschko, and prior to Klitschko, Lennox Lewis. And that was the, you know, jab and grab and lean on a smaller guy, right?
Right.
So I thought he was going to add that to his game and maybe sharpen up on his technique a little bit, maybe sharpen up the jab a little bit and deliver the right hand a little bit straighter. But I didn't think he was going to come forward nonstop the way he did. I thought he was going to mix it in, mix it up a little bit. And I thought if he did do that, it might be a mistake the way it was for who's another guy? The other guy from Detroit. He's a junior middleweight, Harrison. Tony Harrison.
Tony Harrison.
Okay,
yeah,
the rematch. Sorry. You know, Harrison got the W against Jermell Charlo doing his stick and move thing, right?
Right.
And it was controversial, but whatever. He got the W and he got the WBC belt, right? So they had the rematch, the delayed rematch. And he switched it up. And he took the fight to Charlo. And it was effective, right? Round after round, it's effective. It's a good fight. But eventually he got clipped late in the fight.
Right.
So that's what my concern was when Tyson was talking about that. I was thinking that kind of scenario could happen. But it turns out he knew what was up. It was the right move, you know. So I was a Fury believer coming into this fight. I liked him on points. I thought he would make enough. I thought he would be healthy enough, healthier than the first fight, and make enough adjustments. But I thought the adjustments would be minor. But he would just have more confidence in the rematch than he did going into the first bout. And he would avoid getting dropped. And I thought he would win a unanimous decision. But he one-upped it, man. That's the great thing about boxing, man. It's like dudes will flip the script, you know, and even when they're telling you, and this is, I will say this, I think this is one of Tyson's best assets, one of his biggest strengths, you know, apart from having a boxing IQ, being a huge dude, you know, and having a lot of courage, a lot of heart, a lot of character. He's unpredictable. And that's something that throws Wilder off and a lot of his opponents off. And I think it threw off Vladimir Klitschko as well. Is they don't know when he's being serious or not. And that goes for the rest of us. He could say stuff, and he's so, it doesn't bother him at all. He'll just throw it out there like, yeah, I masturbate seven times a day. Why does he say, he says that just to see, okay, let's see if these jokers run with it. And all these jokers run with it because everyone's desperate. They want clicks and they want views and they right. want, you know, people will repeat anything now. And that makes a guy like him even stronger.
Right,
because it'll get back to his opponent's ears,
right?
And it clouds their thinking, and they're like, "What the hell? What's going on?" You know, but then he'll say something serious, like, "Yeah, I'm putting on a lot of weight. I'm coming in at 270, 275."
Right.
And now the dude's like, "Well, is that a joke too? I don't know. They don't know what to think." You know, I thought it was a mistake for Wilder to put on all that weight. I didn't think it was a good thing that he was 231. Mm-hmm. I thought he looked top heavy, you know, but that's the thing. And Fury will throw that stuff out there. And I'll give you another example. He was visited in camp by a British writer, a guy named Gareth A. Davies,
right,
who's a correspondent for The Ring. And I think, I don't know if it was something that Gareth wrote for us or if it was for like a podcast or one of his British radio things.
Mm-hmm.
But it was early in Tyson's camp and Tyson told Gareth that he was dipping his hands in petrol like the old time fighters.
Oh, what?
to make the skin tougher on his hands, right? To make his his hands harder, right?
Right.
Which is absolute poppycock. You're not going to make your hands stronger doing that. But he just tossed that out there to see who would run with it. And at the Wednesday press conference, if you go back and watch that, Wilder's going on a little tirade saying, you know, I rescued you from depression and I rehabilitated you. I picked you up and brought you back to the big time, you know, not the other way around. And he said, and since then you've had 10 trainers and now you're even dipping your hands in gasoline. He said that. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, man.
He got back to him.
Why are you even repeating that? That's obvious. It's obvious nonsense, man. But it's in Wilder's. It was in Wilder's head. He said that. He repeated it. Once Tyson gets you to repeat some goofy crap, he's got you.
Right.
He's got you, man. Yeah, I think I honestly think Wilder just put too much on his shoulders. You know, right. I just think he overdid it. And the fight being in Black History Month, I didn't have any problem with like Andreas Hell asking Wilder about, you know, the significance of Black History Month. It was Wilder's choice to say, you know, I'm going to make this a Black History meme or a Black History trivia question or whatever. And,
right.
You know, but like the walk-in, do you know who the rapper was? He was good. I heard him say Inglewood a bunch of times. So I'm like, oh, is
yeah,
that Inglewood?
I heard that too. Yeah.
it was, do you know who it is? I don't even know.
I forgot.
I'm an old guy. I'm almost 50.
No, I honestly don't.
The song was like Black Magic, Black This, Black right. This, Black That, Black Magic, Black This, Black What, you know. But I'm okay with, I don't have a problem with him doing that. But if doing that adds pressure to you, like, I got to do this for the culture.
Right.
I got to do this for Black people. I got to do this for Black history. If that stresses you out and causes you to run out of energy quicker in the fight, then that was a mistake. I'm sorry. Better to keep it as a sporting event, you know, and just a reminder, it's like, you know, Deontay, you're not Jack Johnson.
Right.
And Fury is not James Jeffries, you know, or, you know, you're not, it's not 1982. You ain't Larry Holmes and Fury ain't Jerry Cooney. It's not the same dynamic. It really isn't. And Fury distanced himself from that. You know, whenever somebody tried to, you know, like a mainstream member of the media would try to kind of make it about that or insinuate that the first fight had a racial undertones.
Yeah.
And I don't remember anything like that. I don't remember that, but whatever. It's interesting.
Dougie, you've obviously been in and around the boxing industry for about 20 years now. How big in terms of the fight week did this feel?
It was huge. It was a big atmosphere. Was it as big as, it was about on par with Canelo Chavez, but instead of all Mexicans on the MGM properties, it was a lot of Americans and a lot of Brits and a lot of African Americans, which was great.
Right.
And a lot of folks from the South, which was awesome. And a lot of casual fans, a lot of dudes that I could tell knew not much about boxing. They were NASCAR and NFL fans, you know, and they had Southern accents and it was all good. It was pretty cool. I would say, you know, it wasn't like Mayweather McGregor or Mayweather Pacquiao. It wasn't on that level. No, it wasn't. As a matter of fact, I think it was a little bit underneath Canelo Triple G1. Okay. But in terms of a heavyweight championship bout or a heavyweight rematch, it was as big as Lennox Lewis versus Evander Holyfield 2, which was at the Thomas and Mack in 99. And I was at that fight. I covered that. Or Lennox Lewis versus Hossein Rockman 2, which was at the Mandalay Bay in 2001. And I covered that for Max Boxing. So that's a long time. That's going way back. So it's been a long time.
After this, do you think we'll see Top Rank and PBC work together more?
Yeah. Yeah, why not? I mean, unless PBC is bitter, you know, unless something happens. I mean, the money, listen, at the end of the day, PBC has to appease Fox Sports.
Right.
Because they have a multi-million deal, multi-year, multi-million deal with them. At the end of the day, Top Rank wants to make ESPN happy because they have a multi-million, multi-year deal. And if the pay-per-view does well, and hey, the gate was awesome. If the pay-per-view tracks well, excuse me. Sorry, guys, my voice is still just trash from that dry desert air and all that smoke, you know, in the arena, but not in the arena, just in the casino itself.
Right.
If they just do 1 million pay-per-view, right, which I think is a success, they're going to want to do more. They're going to want to collaborate more because there are big fights that can be made by matching PBC fighters with Top Rank fighters. And Top Rank has an amazing welterweight named Terrence Crawford. Now, I don't know if Errol Spence is ready to get you know, go right into a super fight like that. But PBC has a pretty deep welterweight stable, and I think we're all tired of seeing, you know, Crawford fight the likes of the Mean Machine. We want to see him in with at least a well-known welterweight, and even if it's Danny Garcia or Keith Thurman, there would be interest in that. And I think that's like those kind of matchups, you can sell them. So I'm hopeful of that, unless Pride gets the better of folks, you know, like Pride's great for the boxers themselves. It's not good for anybody else. It's not good for the promoters, not good for the cornermen. It's not good for the media. Let's hope people can work together, but it seemed like they got along. From my vantage point, it didn't seem contentious.
Dougie, you mentioned the live gate. This is obviously a significant gate, especially for a heavyweight championship fight.
Yeah.
They reportedly did just under 17. It was like 16.9 million. And I think Lennox Lewis and Holyfield did like 16.8 or something like that. And from you as a you know, a boxing historian, obviously being in the game for that long, in terms of like the financials, like do you count like this weekend's gate higher than that one?
Not if you adjust for inflation.
Exactly.
No,
yeah.
I mean the 2020 dollar is not as strong as the 1999 dollar. You know? And the 1999 dollar isn't as strong as the 1981 dollar. You know, no, it's like, you know, when you look at Ray Leonard's $10 million guaranteed purses in the early 80s, you know, like fighting Duran and Hearns and stuff, like that was crazy money. The dollar was strong back then.
Right.
But I mean, you know, it's whatever. It's still, these guys are doing great though. I mean, a near $17 million gate is sensational. It hopefully it sets up bigger fights. You know, maybe if they do a third match, immediate or not, if it goes back to Vegas, it could be even bigger. That's why I think maybe they shouldn't do an immediate third match, just because Wilder got thrashed so thoroughly. It's kind of like he needs to build back up his rep and show us a few wrinkles against other guys, you know, and then maybe they can revisit it in 2021. But the business is the business, you know, and maybe, you know, who knows, maybe Al and the PBC would be like, you know what, you know, rather than watch Bob Arum take Fury over to Sir Eddie and have Fury fight, Anthony Joshua. And, you know, the prospect of Fury possibly winning that and being the undisputed heavyweight champion. It's like, oh, crap. That's going to be difficult to deal with, you know what I mean?
Right.
If Arum controls the man at heavyweight, and if Fury is able to do that, it's not beyond the realm of possibility, right? You guys would probably pick Fury over or Joshua, or maybe, you know, he's at least a live dog in that matchup. You know, gosh, you know, Fury wouldn't just be the undisputed heavyweight champ. I mean, he would be a global superstar. So that might scare them a little bit. Like, you know what? Let's preempt that, you know. Let's toss Wilder in again and hold that off and cross our fingers and hope Deontay lands the big right hand this time.
Dougie, the AJ Fury fight is obviously the one that we all want. Have you heard any rumors on how DAZN and ESPN would work together with DAZN not having a pay-per-view?
I don't know how they would work that out, but there has to be a way. You have to come to the table. You have to talk about it. I mean, you know, ESPN and Fox figured it out. They figured it out, and it worked. It worked. I thought the promotion worked. I thought the marketing push was unprecedented. I thought these two huge sports platforms in the United States, Fox and ESPN, treated a heavyweight championship like the NBA finals. And that was incredible. So, you know, you got to figure ESPN can figure something out with DAZN. Like, you know, DAZN can have live international rights, but it's ESPN in the United States, ESPN pay-per-view. And then maybe, you know, for 1 week, all the replays are on DAZN, you know. Right. I went to school for journalism. I didn't go to school for business. So you know, I can't draw up a damn contract, you know,
right.
But I shouldn't have to. These guys are you know, these business majors and law majors, you know, who have experience in showbiz and the sports world, they need to figure it out. It shouldn't fall on us.
You're right.
It shouldn't fall on the media and fans to, like, figure out how these guys can work together. I mean, come on. It's just there's no losers in it. There's no losers if these guys work together. They're all going to make money, you know. They just need to be willing to take some risks. Because when you risk, you can win big, like Fury did. He took some risks. That's why he entered the ring to crazy. It's like, yeah, I'm crazy. I'm going to do something crazy. Watch. It worked out.
Dougie, being a boxing historian, I just want to throw one at you. Tyson Fury, the best performance by a British fighter on away soil since?
Oh, wow. Oh, you know, Lewis had a lot, man. Dude, Lewis, listen, man. Lennox Lewis kicked ass. And I was one of his critics. But Lewis, listen. I was there. I was at Madison Square Garden when Lennox Lewis obliterated Michael Grant. And maybe you guys don't remember, but Michael Grant was supposed to be the second coming. Mm-hmm. He was supposed to be the next dominant American heavyweight. He was the great American hope. There used to be a great white hope. He was the great black hope, the great African-American hope. And he was supposed to be just the modern era heavyweight. And Lennox Lewis wiped his ass with Grant. And Lennox Lewis, the rematch with Hasim Rockman, that was awesome. Nassim Hamed against my man Kevin Kelly, that was impressive. Lennox Lewis Tyson, I kind of tossed that out. Tyson was kind of a shell of himself by then,
right?
It was still, you know, still impressive. You know, you can go back to the 80s with Lloyd Hunnigan shocking the world against Donald Curry. That was a big deal at the time because Curry was like number one pound for pound. He wasn't just the undisputed welterweight champ. So there's been some impressive British performances, and I've witnessed a few, which I'm proud of. But yeah, generally speaking. And most of the great British performances are on British soil, you know, like Ricky Hatton over and Kostya Zou, you know, or Joe Calzaghe against Jeff Lacy in Wales, you know.
Right.
Calzaghe did pretty. Calzaghe had a couple of his last two fights against Bernard Hopkins and Roy Jones. Jones was kind of washed.
Yeah, he was.
But Bernard, you know what? That counts because Bernard went on to still kick some ass, you know.
Yeah.
To that, you know, even though I think Bernard was like 43 years old, you know, and you know, the fact that he got up from a first round knockdown and to outpoint a boxing master, a technician and neutralizer like Bernard Hopkins, that's impressive. And the fact that, you know, Hopkins in his very next fight undressed Kelly Pavlik. And then, you know, regained the light heavyweight title as the oldest boxer ever in any weight class, you know, against Jean Pascal and then went on to beat, you know, a bunch of other guys. That's a pretty good win from old Joe. So there's been a bunch, but Fury over Wilder in that rematch, that's right up there. That's right near the top, I would say.
So, Dougie, moving on to this Saturday on DAZN, February 29th from the Star in Frisco, Texas, just outside of Dallas on DAZN, as I mentioned. Mikey Garcia comes at his second fight at 147 against Jesse Vargas. What do you think about that?
I think it's weird that he's staying at 147, to be quite honest. I just don't see him as a welterweight. But I think the money's there. In America, welterweight's like the lightest glamour division, you know, and it's like night and day being a lightweight or a junior welterweight and being at 147 pounds. So I think Mikey's always been a businessman and he wants to make the most money for each fight. He made a grip of money in that loss to Errol Spence, and he's being paid very well for this fight. What is it? It's at least $5 million guaranteed, if not $7 million.
I think it's seven. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of money coming off a shutout loss.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not bad, you know. So I see why he's doing it, but I think it's going to be difficult for him because Jesse Vargas is 5'11". He's very experienced. He's got a nice jab. He's got a good chin. You know, when have you seen Jesse Vargas hurt?
Right.
When have we even seen him drop, you know?
Oh, he was dropped by Pacquiao.
Pacquiao got him? Yeah. Pacquiao probably got him at an angle, just speed and punching at an odd angle.
Right.
Different styles here. I think Vargas is live. You know, Vargas has never got over that hump when he's in there with sort of an elite name, you know, or a big name. He gets held to a draw or, he loses or whatever, but he's got that experience. I mean, you know, Vargas went 12 rounds with Pacquiao, 12 rounds with Tim Bradley, rocked the hell out of Bradley in the 12th round. I thought he did enough to beat DeLorme and Broner. I thought those should have been close wins
for
Jesse. I might be a little biased here. I like Jesse. I've always liked him. I've known him since he was a, 5-0 pup, back when he was trained by Roger Mayweather. So I like the guy. I like Mikey too, but I'm closer to Jesse, but I'm just going to say it. I think Vargas is a live dog. I think it's a good fight. I think it'll be competitive.
Dougie, we were at Mikey's camp on the last week on Friday, and they were saying that, Mikey's chasing that fifth world title in the welterweight division. You think that's something he can get?
Well, who's the weak link? Who would he go for? Would he fight? Who that has a title? I mean, I guess if he gets a shot at Manny Pacquiao, style-wise, maybe he's live in that because Pacquiao is 40, maybe 41 now. He's going on 41. And he's not a natural welterweight. He's a guy who came up from the lighter weight classes, just like Mikey did. And Mikey's got that counterpuncher technician style, like Juan Manuel Marquez. Maybe Pacquiao, if he can get that, I can see he would be live in that one. But I don't, he can't beat. Well, maybe I don't know what's left of Errol Spence, but Spence showed him that Spence was the man at welterweight against a top lightweight. Who are the other title holders? Terrence Crawford? Mikey has no shot against Terrence Crawford.
Spence.
Who else? Who am I leaving out?
Spence, Crawford. Who else are we missing? Who has WBA?
Pacquiao, WBA.
Pacquiao. I think it's just them, right? In terms of the primaries? I think.
Yeah. So I guess, the BC was... that was picked up by Spence when he beat Porter, right?
Yeah. He has the IBF and the BC.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, listen, let's say Spence is not able to return this year, or when he does return, he's got to fight like a mid-level dude or whatever. I think the IBF is already having two guys fight for like an interim title, Sergey Lipinets against that Quadratilio dude.
Right.
And maybe the WBC does that, like, let's have an interim title, or we'll strip them from the title and make how they do. They'll make Spence the champion in recess or champion emeritus or whatever, they'll come up with a title,
You mentioned,
but maybe if he fights just somebody for a vacant title, in the WBC, maybe that could be interesting. It would be kind of cool. Is like a crossroads match, like Mikey Garcia versus a young gun like Victor Ortiz Jr.
Oh wow,
Jerron Ennis. Oh, it'll wow. never. They he won't do it. But that would be awesome, man. That'd be like, okay, Mikey, you wanted to be 147 pounder, fight one of these young lions. I don't think that'll happen. If I'm Mikey Garcia and I beat Jesse Vargas and I want to stay at 147 to get that fifth world title, it's a no-brainer. Go for the legendary name. Go for Manny Pacquiao. His style should be difficult for Pacquiao.
You don't think, though, in that regard, that obviously Mikey's already mentioned in interviews that he wants Pacquiao, and obviously a lot of people want Pacquiao who are in and around that weight.
Sure, who doesn't?
But you don't think that somebody like Al Haymon and the PBC brass would be hesitant to give it to Mikey because Mikey's already shown an unwillingness to commit long term to anybody. But
Pacquiao only has one fight left with his PBC contract. That was a three fight deal.
That's right. Yeah.
So if you're gonna capitalize on Pacquiao, you got to do it. Who else are they gonna do it with? Unless the PBC does like a a co-promotion with UFC with Pacquiao versus McGregor, which would probably make a buttload of money, you know, and maybe that's all they're thinking about right now, because I think they lost money on those pay-per-views. Even though those pay-per-views, the Broner and the Thurman, the pay-per-views did well, I think. But, you know, Pacquiao's $20 million guarantee,
that's a lot, yeah.
That's tough. Yeah, that's tough to do business with.
Huh. Well, the reason I asked that, because I thought about it more like that Heyman would probably want somebody like a Danny Garcia, somebody he obviously knows who's loyal to him. Because if they get the win, then he still has them in the stable.
And, yeah, they got that. Yeah, the fighter gets elevated because he beat a legend, you know, plus he gets the belt.
Right, right.
And yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. But you know what makes sense to me? Mikey Garcia fighting at 140. Yeah. I'm sorry. There's just a lot of talent at 140. You know, I'd love to see how Mikey mixes up with guys like Jose Ramirez and Regis Progre. Man, that would be a war.
Yeah.
Garcia Progre, man, forget about it. You know, and of course, Josh Taylor. I like the 140-pound division, and I just think it's more natural for Mikey. Even if he has to sort of make the weight, you know, I just think he's probably more effective, probably have more power at that weight right now. But I understand it. I get it. I get why guys do it. You know, Robert Guerrero did that. You know, he was a featherweight, and then he moved up to lightweight, and he was real strong at lightweight. I thought he could have really made some noise at 135 or even 140 pounds, but he went to 147 because that's where the money is. They were punishing fights. You know, he stopped scoring knockouts. He had some wins and he had some losses, but he made a lot more money as a welterweight than he ever would have as a lightweight or a junior welterweight. And of course he got that shot at Floyd Mayweather. So I get it.
Turning our attentions to the next fight, and probably, I would guess, your favorite fight on this card, Dougie. Calufay against Roman Chocolatito Gonzalez for the WBA super flyweight.
God bless him.
The king is back, right?
He is, forever, now and forever. Regardless of what happens on Saturday, Chocolatito is the king. And for what it's worth, he was my fighter of the decade.
Do you think he can roll it back for one night?
What's that?
Do you think he can roll back the years for one night?
Guys, I got to be honest with you. I have no idea. You know, based on what I've seen in the ring, I don't know. It's inconclusive. You know, he fought a journeyman in Japan.
Right.
And prior to that, he was out of the ring for a little over a year with an injury. Prior to that, he's beaten like a fringe contender. And he bludgeoned the dude. It took him a couple rounds to kind of get into his rhythm. And then prior to that, he was annihilated by Sri Saketso Rungvisai.
Twice.
And prior to that, guess what? I thought he won that fight of the year candidate, that first fight with Sorungvisai. But regardless, whether he won or not, it was a grueling 12 rounds. And prior to that, there was a grueling 12 rounds against Carlos Quadras.
Right.
Prior to that, he was starting to struggle with weight, making 112, and against Arroyo. That was not an easy fight. You know, at some point, you hit your ceiling. And I thought he hit his physical limit at flyweight, probably his last really strong performances at flyweight was the title win against Yagashi,
right,
in Japan. And then Brian Valoria's last stand in 2015 at Madison Square Garden. And that was probably probably his last peak form, because he was struggling after that, man. It was tough. It was hard. And I heard Nitwit say, oh, he struggled against this dude. He's not that good. I'm like, you're not seeing him in his prime, you dunces. Right. You know, his prime was like, you know, a straw weight. It was at 108 pounds, in my opinion, junior flyweight. That's his best weight, you know. But whatever. I'm glad he had his time in the sun. I'm glad he hooked up with Tom Loeffler, and Loeffler was able to convince HBO to put him under the Big Drama Show. As the Little Drama Show under the Triple G Promotions. And he got that HBO exposure and he got that money. You know, I think that's great. And, you know, these little guys, they, you know, look at Nonito Donaire. He had one last great effort in him against Naoya Inoue. And anybody but Inoue would have been beaten by Donaire that night. So Chocolatito, I've heard the camp is good. I've heard he's in good spirits. I heard his form is good. I heard his weight is good. So if it's all good, I believe in him. I think he'll get it done. I think he'll outwork Yafai and win a close but unanimous decision. Whatever happens, you know, he's always the king.
Dougie, for kind of the new people that are listening to this podcast that haven't seen Chima Chocolatito's best fights, what fights
would you... Do you think people listen to your podcast and have never seen a Roman Gonzalez fight? Who the hell?
Mike's an idiot.
You guys cater to hardcore fans?
Yeah, our fan base is hardcore fans.
People? Oh, I never heard of him. Then you're not a boxing fan, dude. You got no excuse. He was fighting on HBO. It's not like he was just fighting in Nicaragua, Mexico, and Japan, okay? It's like, dudes, he was on some big cards, but whatever, go on.
Mike just embarrassed himself.
What fights would you tell him to go back and watch?
Who the hell, honestly,
the hell, Mike?
When you're on Twitter, who out there is saying Chocolatito isn't a badass? Yeah. Who out there doesn't believe he isn't a first ballot Hall of Famer?
Yeah.
Show me the person who says that, and I'll show you an ignorant fan. No, honestly, I will show you somebody who started following boxing 3 years ago.
Right.
Show you somebody who, you know, can't even name five heavyweights, you know, let alone super flyweights, you know what I mean? So I don't know, but go on.
Redeem yourself, Mike. Go ahead.
I think I should probably just skip to another question, right? I was going to say, could you tell us a list of obviously you're a huge fan of Chocolatito, some of the fights for people to go back and watch that may have missed them somehow.
Listen, here's the great thing about Chocolatito. Doesn't matter. It's the same style against everybody. It's a pressure fighter, a technical volume punching, combination punching, body head specialist, technician, systematically cut off the ring and break people down no matter what their style or athletic gifts or experience level is. He just broke everybody down systematically. He walked him down behind a jab. As soon as he got into range, it was body head combinations. And he was a technician, like a Mike McCallum, like tight jab, right hand, hook to the body, hook to the head, uppercut, right cross hook, you know, and then back out, back to the jab. Then back in, body, upstairs, downstairs, wear that sucker out. And he stopped most of his opponents. The fight that I was privileged to be there live at the Sports Arena in late 2012, where he was at his peak, in my humble opinion, at 108 pounds, defending the WBA title against a then unknown Mexican prospect named Juan Francisco Estrada, who went on in his very next fight after being beaten by Chocolatito. In his very next fight, Estrada steps up to flyweight and dethrones Brian Valoria. Dang. For two world titles and travels to Macau to do it.
Dang.
I mean, like, that's how good that dude was. And they fought tooth and nail, and Estrada fought as well as a fighter can, backing up. And Chocolatito fought as well as a fighter can, coming forward. And it was a beautiful matchup of styles. So find that fight. 2012. Roman Gonzalez versus Juan Francisco Estrada, who is the current Ring Magazine and WBC 115-pound champion, and he's in most people's pound-for-pound list. He's a complete fighter from Mexico, and he's something else.
The next fight in that card, we've got the up-and-coming Julio Cesar Martinez, 15-1, against the Brit Jay Harris. What do you think of Martinez?
I like him. He's a quintessential Mexican-style fighter. He comes to scrap. I think he's from the Sonora, Sinaloa area. So like, you know, Julio Cesar Chavez country, goes to the body, with a lot of spirit. And he's hooked up with Eddie Reynoso, who has emerged as an elite young trainer. And Reynoso knows how to teach craft. He doesn't just get his guys in good shape. So I expect him to continue to improve, and he's an action fighter. He's fun to watch.
Dougie, you know, kind of turning back to the Wilder Fury, something that happened during that week, and we're pretty sure that you were right there, and I kind of just wanted to get your initial reaction when you heard about the news, even though it's kind of repetitive and it's kind of expected behavior. Adrian Broner gets arrested for trespassing up there.
Yeah.
When you found out, what you think?
What do I think about him? He was just, he was banned from the MGM properties last November for being a drunk hooligan the night of the Canelo Kovalev fight.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get banned from a casino, when they spot you, when they see you, and he was in the media center doing interviews and he was doing well too. He was doing a good job, and you know, he was there for the weigh-in. So he went to the weigh-in and they spotted him and they escorted him. So that's what happened. You know, he has a short memory, obviously, or you know what, or he just thought it's not that serious. I'm Adrian Broner. I'm connected.
Right.
You know, I can just say I'm Adrian Broner, or hey, go talk to Al Heyman, or,
right.
or talk to Sam Watson, or you know, talk to Tim Smith, talk to somebody with the PBC. You know, I don't know. You know, maybe he thought he would holler out Bandcamp, and the security guards would be impressed. But no, he seemed fine. He didn't seem to be causing any trouble in the media center anyways. He's on the ban list. And so he's not supposed to be in that casino. Maybe they'll let him in New York.
Dougie, were you able to present the belt, the Ring Magazine belt to Tyson Fury?
No, dude, let me tell you.
Wow.
Man, no, I was not allowed in that ring. The ring is on the S list. Can you curse on this podcast?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. We're on Deontay Wilder and JD's a shit list. Wilder has not been happy with us since after the first Fury fight. The ring ratings panel elevated Fury from number 7 to number 1.
Oh, wow.
He fought him, and he remained at number 2, and he felt that he won that fight, or he felt that he should be number 1. So he wasn't happy about that. And JD's had an axe to grind with me because he felt that the magazine snubbed the first fight. It should have been on the cover.
Right.
And I do think the first fight was cover worthy. I would love to do it because heavyweights sell, especially if you have American and a Brit. Because that's where the magazine sells in the UK and the US.
Mm-hmm.
It's an English magazine. Go figure. English language magazine, right? So the fight fell between magazine cycles. It just it happens. Like I would have liked to have covered better the Lomachenko Rigondeaux fight, but it happened early in December, just like the a year later that Fury Wilder one would. And that's what happens with magazines. But he wasn't satisfied with that answer. Like he was saying, like, well, I see, in October and November and December, you had Canelo Alvarez and, on the cover, and you had Eddie Hearn on the cover, and you had somebody else on the cover, and it's like, bro, the month that's on the cover of a magazine, that's not the month that we actually made the magazine, that we produced the magazine. That month on the cover is a note to the newsstand vendors to take that magazine down and put up a new one. So here, just to give you an example, it's the month of February right now. The magazine that we're going to put to bed this week is the May 2020 issue of Ring Magazine.
Wow.
So it's like 4 months in advance. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It'll be out. It'll be on newsstands at the end of March.
Wow.
And that's the way it is. So people look at the, well, why didn't you cover? It's like, no, the fight hadn't even been announced. but also in our defense, that, you know, JD's had a little bit of revisionist history there, because the fight turned out to be this great dramatic fight with that 12th round. But going into it, we didn't know what to expect from Fury. Fury hadn't beaten any top 10 contender. He was 2 bouts into his comeback. He had been out of the ring for like 2.5 years. He was still losing weight. He still looked like a fat slob, even in his second comeback fight.
Right.
A lot of people didn't even know if he would get through a full training camp. So what, you know.
Yeah.
Business history. But here's the thing about boxing, guys. This is one thing I've learned. and I've been writing about boxing since the mid-90s, and it's been full-time for 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. Since January of 2000.
Right.
Somebody is always pissed at you. Somebody's always salty. And they might be salty today, and they might be cool with you tomorrow. That's boxing. So I don't worry about it. I'm not mad about it. I didn't make a big deal about it. I asked some of the PR people, hey, you know, can we have the belt present, visible at the press conference? The Fury side was cool. The PV side didn't answer us. They didn't acknowledge us, right? You know, and then I inquired about getting like a little sticker thing to get in the ring, and they're like, no, not a chance, bub.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, that's fine. You know, and then so it's so funny. I kept having people on Twitter say, hey, what are you going to do if Deontay Wilder rejects the belt, you know?
Right.
I don't know, saw that, and I kept saying, he hasn't won the fight yet. They got to fight the fight, my
right.
man. So, you know, but, at you know, listen, hey, had Wilder won, you wouldn't have seen the ring belt.
Right.
And at the post-fight press conference, JD's probably would have said some disparaging words towards us. It is what it
right.
is. If somebody brought up the ring or whatever.
Right,
maybe
right.
he wouldn't. I don't know. I don't know. But I'm so elated that Fury did what he said he was going to do, because Fury wanted that belt. And let me give a shout out to Evan Korn, PR ace for Top Rank Boxing.
Right.
After the knockout, I'm in shock for about like a minute. Like, holy shit, they stopped it. He did. He actually got a knockout.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm remembering, oh, wait, the ring title is right by my side. It's like in a duffel bag. I hand the duffel bag to Evan. I say, Evan, get that to the ring. He's like, what is this? I say, that's the ring title. And he's like, oh, they're okay. and he's kind of, and I go, go, Evan, go. Go, Evan, go. And he, man, he was like, I don't know if you're old enough to remember O.J. Simpson and the yeah. airport commercials running through the airport and slipping and sliding. But he, I don't know how he did it, because it wasn't just sold out. It was oversold. The Grand Garden Arena.
It right.
was standing room only. Like, even in the aisles, there were bodies everywhere, you know. He's a little skinny dude. He just slipped through them, though. I mean, at amazing speed.
Right.
And by the time he was being announced the winner, he had both belts. It was incredible. He had the WBC and the Ring Magazine title.
Right.
And these money shots with him, his hands in the air with both belts everywhere. So whether or not the ring announcer said and knew, or once again, Ring Magazine champion, or I don't know if the broadcasters mentioned it, because often they don't. But, you know, and I know a lot of boxing writers don't mention it, which is cool. I mean, even guys I'm friends with, like Steve Kim, he doesn't mention the ring titles. But a picture is worth 1,000 words, and that picture is everywhere. Right.
Absolutely.
In fact, probably going to be our cover.
Absolutely.
So I was like, yes, man.
Absolutely.
And here's the great thing. So D's probably would have ripped Ring Magazine at Wilder 1 during the press fight post-conference. Tyson Fury's trainer, Sugar Hill Stewart, he holds the belt up, the Ring Magazine belt up, and he puts it on.
Wow.
I love it.
That's
so
great.
You had two iconic brands there, Kronk Gym and Ring Magazine. It's awesome.
Man, well, on that note, Dougie, you know, we appreciate your time. You know, it's always great to talk to you, especially after a big, big fight like this. And, you know, obviously people can find you at the Ring Magazine and stuff.
Yep.
And you know.
Follow me on Twitter at Dougie Fisher and Instagram.
Oh, yeah. You're definitely a follow for boxing fans with the haters and the lovers. The haters and the lovers.
I love the salty society. And there's a new salty society. You got two of them. The big one is for Canelo.
Right.
Second place is for AJ.
Yeah.
And now for Tyson Fury. Because Wilder fans are mad.
They're always going to be
salty.
There. They're always going to be there.
Yeah. So I love the saltiness. It's part of boxing.
Absolutely.
Next time I come on the podcast, I'll tell you about it. Like, there's always somebody upset with you, and I'll give you the whole lineage of people who were pissed off at Doug Fisher or Max Boxing, or mad at Steve Kim and hate me because they associate me with Steve Kim. I was often guilty by association, so, but it's a long list, man.
Yeah,
but they're mad at you 1 year and then they love you the next year, so
right, you're right, you're
I
right.
have perspective.
Well, thanks a lot, Dougie.
All right, guys.
You're welcome anytime on the podcast, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, man. Take care. Well, Mike, you know, let's wrap it up here. end this show. We went a little long, but it's okay. So follow us on Twitter, guys, Instagram, at The Last Round 12, on social media, at The Last Round on Facebook. And tune in next week as we reviewed Mikey Garcia versus Jesse Vargas this weekend on DAZN. So for my co-host, Michael Shepard, I'm Danny Z. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Last Round 12.